The House comes for oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. Duncan Webb.
Well, kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker, the government has provided significant support to businesses and workers in response to the Delta COVID-19 outbreak. I received a report yesterday that told me that we have paid out over $6 billion through the wage subsidy scheme and resurgence support payments since August when the outbreak began. Under the wage subsidy scheme, 1,116,851 applications have been approved, totalling a payout of $4.3 billion. For the resurgence support payment, the payout has been $1.76 billion. Mr. Speaker, we know that it has been particularly tough for those businesses in Auckland, and as we move to the new COVID protection framework, we will ensure that we provide support to businesses through this transition.
What other reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Well, Mr. Speaker, Statistics New Zealand reported that seasonally adjusted retail sales fell by 8.1% in the September quarter due to the Delta outbreak and higher alert levels. The decline in spending affected all categories other than groceries, while Auckland experienced the largest fall by region. On an annual basis, however, retail sales rose 8.6%. ASB's economist said the fall was not as sharp as had been feared, and it highlighted the New Zealand economy's resilience. Westpac's economist noted that while retail spending did take a knock in September, the slowdown looks temporary. They pointed out that spending has recovered since then and that they expect it will firm heading into the Christmas period.
Further supplementary, what reports has he seen on the impact of the recent change in alert levels on retail spending?
Mr. Speaker, the Auckland retail sector experienced a boost in spending with the easing of restrictions at alert level step 3, step 2. Kiwibank reported that the number of credit card transactions in Auckland rose 35% over the first 5 days at step 2, with the value of spending rising 62%. The BNZ reported that for the week ending Tuesday the 16th of November, card spending rose 27% on the previous week, which brings it 7% higher than pre-Delta levels. Economists say that the lift we have seen in retail spending indicates that a solid rebound in activity will occur as the country moves into the COVID protection framework in the next few days.
Has the Minister of Finance seen any reports about New Zealanders increasingly concerned about the cost of living in New Zealand? And if so, what is he doing to get inflation under control?
Well, Mr. Speaker, throughout my entire time in politics and in this Parliament, I have seen people concerned about the increasing cost of living. On this side of the House, we have continued initiatives throughout our period of time to support low-income New Zealanders particularly, and I look forward to the members' support for any upcoming minimum wage increases.
Question number two, the Honourable Eugene Sage.
Tanako, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for the Environment. Does he consider that trees in our cities and towns are appropriately protected? If so, why?
David Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I agree that the protection of mature and ecologically significant trees in urban areas is an important consideration, and the government is actively considering this as part of the reform of the RMA. It's also important that protections don't create excessive compliance costs for routine pruning or the removal of smaller trees. I'm advised that prior to the changes to the RMA that occurred under the last national government, there were an estimated 4,000 to 5,000 resource consents required to prune or remove trees per year, which is around 10% of total resource consents issued. In addition, many people thought the rules requiring consents were sometimes absurd and ignored them, bringing the RMA into disrepute.
From a climate perspective, is he concerned that in the Waitemata local board area alone, at least 12,879 trees were removed in the 10 years from 2006 to 2016?
From a climate perspective, no. You know, a few hectares of trees elsewhere would more than offset that.
Does he consider that increasing housing density and protecting urban trees are complementary changes that enable livable cities?
Yes.
Will he commit to urgent action to protect urban trees on private land as denser housing is developed so people can enjoy the benefits urban trees provide, including sequestering carbon, creating shade, reducing the urban heat island effect, stormwater runoff?
The member's got quite a few questions in there.
Well, those decisions are delegated under the Resource Management Act for councils to take. Sometimes they have to take difficult decisions. When they go through a process and they consider it and then they give an authorisation for a tree to be felled, for example, for a new housing development, then that process should be respected.
What tools is he considering providing councils to enable effective urban tree protection on private land, and how is this work being prioritised?
The work is being progressed as part of the reform to the RMA through the Natural and Built Environments Act, which we propose, and I'm working with Minister Twyford on that issue as an Associate Minister for the Environment. The Ministry is, I'm aware, working with councils, not just in Auckland, but also across the land to try and land this in the right place.
Question number three, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question's to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, particularly the government's plan to carefully reopen while continuing to protect New Zealanders' lives and livelihoods. New Zealand will move into the COVID-19 protection framework from Friday the 3rd of December, with Cabinet confirming the settings for each region on November the 29th. As we prepare for the introduction of the COVID-19 protection framework, the free New Zealand Pass Verify app to scan and verify my vaccine passes is now available to download. For customers entering a business requiring proof of vaccination status, their My Vaccine Pass can be scanned by the Verify app. The Verify will show a green tick recognising the official QR code that is embedded in the customer's pass. The government has also announced a simplified vaccination assessment tool that will be able to be used mid-December to help employers decide if they'd like to require or believe they need to require vaccination for different types of work. Employers and employees have been asking for certainty on what roles may need to be done by vaccinated workers under the COVID-19 protection framework. This tool provides a clear legal framework to help businesses make decisions about vaccinations in the workplace, and it builds, Mr. Speaker, on the guidance provided by WorkSafe and has had input from Business New Zealand and the CTU.
Why, from December 15th, will a New Zealander be able to fly from Auckland to Wellington with just a vaccine pass, but a Kiwi who wants to fly from Queensland will need to win a slot in managed isolation and then spend a full week in MIQ?
Mr. Speaker, we've indicated that before the end of the year we will be making further announcements on the way that we intend to change the arrangements at the border. We have indicated that MIQ and the requirement to see through an isolation period in the government facilities we do expect and will be changing. And we will be focusing first on citizens and residents. But the second point that I would make, Mr. Speaker, is we are making significant changes at present domestically. I know that there's actually considerable anxiety about some of those changes, and it's upon us to make sure that we get those right domestically, whilst also then very carefully then stepping through changes at the international border as well.
Is she aware that Auckland has more than 4,000 active cases of COVID in the community, while the entire state of Queensland has four?
Mr. Speaker, I refer the member to my previous points that we will be making changes to the way that we're operating at our international border. But I would make the point to the member that, of course, it's not just about picking off individual states at any given time. Queensland intends to open its borders to the rest of Australia, so I don't think it's fair to just simply say one state can be seen as their own individual entity at this current juncture when they will be reopening themselves to other parts of Australia. The second point I'd make to the member is we do need to think about the entire group of New Zealanders who are currently offshore, for whom we need to set out the plans and expectations for their ability to come home. That does not represent just single individuals from Queensland, but actually represents between 40 and 50,000 people who will be looking to return home. So we need to do that safely.
Let them go.
Question number...
I was letting him have his go.
The Honourable Judith
Collins. Right, thank you. Why are travellers from Queensland, a state with just 4 active cases and closed borders with the rest of Australia, still taking up space in MIQ when we now have more than 4,000, in fact, 4,614 New Zealanders right now in the community with COVID?
Mr. Speaker, I again refer to the member now to my 2 previous questions. Again, I would highlight that my recollection is that Queensland is opening up to the rest of Australia on the 17th. I believe it's the 17th of December. So that will no longer be their status as a closed state to the rest of Australia. The second point that I would again highlight for the member is that we do intend to change the way that we're operating at the border, but we will continue to have in place measures to ensure that we have checks, because we know that with some of the modelling that's occurred around cases that are likely to come in from offshore, even with pre-departure testing, vaccination checks, and even with a period of self-isolation, modelling suggests that we will have a not insignificant number of cases seeded as a result of that. And as Dr. Verrill, up to 60 potentially, Mr. Bishop, that's with those protections. So yes, we have risk tolerance, but we still need to be cautious, because as Dr. Verrill has said, just because you are managing a domestic fire doesn't make it okay to go around a forest lighting matches.
Mark Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does she believe it acceptable conduct of a minister in her government to label tens of thousands of New Zealanders attending groundswell protest as a, quote, mixture of racists and anti-vax, and how does this not fit into the proposed definition of hate speech, that is to use words that are threatening, abusive or insulting and likely to excite hostility or ill will?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the premise of that member's question.
Mark Cameron.
Will she agree to meet the groundswell organisers this Thursday when they deliver their petition on behalf of tens of thousands of New Zealanders to Parliament?
Mr. Speaker, I conduct and will continue to conduct regular engagements. In fact, some of the most regular engagements I have are with Dairy New Zealand, Beef and Lamb, our horticultural representatives and federated farmers. I will continue to meet with those representative bodies, as I have done throughout my time as Prime Minister.
Thank you. What is her response to the Managing Director of Flight Centre, who said today, quote, "It's been over 100 days since the government released its plan to reopen New Zealand. Since then, there has been absolutely no guidance on when the reopening might commence," end quote. When will she provide that guidance?
Mr. Speaker, actually, we said it at the time in August. We set out our plans and we've actually followed through on each of them. We said that we would undertake a self-isolation pilot. We have done that and we are doing that. We have said that we would look at shortened MIQ from the 14th of November. We have done that. MIQ is now shortened. We said from the first quarter of next year that we intended to move towards self-isolation. We have committed to that. And as I say to the member, I look forward to sharing more details of that before the end of the year to provide greater certainty for New Zealanders offshore. The other point I would make, Mr. Speaker, this is not a zero-sum game. There is no country around the world that has open borders and no consequences. There are choices. If you make choices that you're going to operate your borders in that way, then you will have greater domestic restrictions. We are working towards a very fine balance in New Zealand where we have the fewest restrictions possible in our domestic environment, whilst, of course, moving towards allowing New Zealanders to return home. And that is what we are working towards.
So what does she say to Air New Zealand, which has cancelled thousands of flights, and explained, quote, "Our hands are tied until border restrictions ease and we receive further clarity from the New Zealand government," end quote. When does she expect to provide that clarity?
Mr. Speaker, Air New Zealand, of course, had bookings from the 1st through to the 30th of December. And of course, we have indicated that we expect in the first quarter of next year to have self-isolation, which will enable some of the congestion we've expected experienced at the border to change. And so obviously Air New Zealand have made decisions based on the signals we have given, and we intend to give even further clarity from there.
And what are the criteria for a region to move from red to orange to green under the traffic light system?
Mr. Speaker, we've already indicated that at this stage for the transition, the most important factor will be vaccination levels. Obviously, the member will also be aware that because we've indicated that Auckland will also go into red, that clearly the outbreak in Auckland is also a factor in the number of cases. Readiness and the ability of the health system to manage cases as they arise. So predominantly health measures, but that's not solely the factors we'll take into account.
When does she expect to provide New Zealanders with clear criteria rather than just predominantly as part of the answer she's just given?
Mr. Speaker, clearly the member's discounting everything I said in the answer to that question, including the reference to high vaccination levels. We've said those that are sitting, you know, well under those goals of 90% can expect to go into red, which I would add is very similar to the status that most parts of the country are experiencing right now in level two, but with vaccination passes added. We'll be talking in more detail about the process for further assessments on the 29th of November.
Does the South Island currently meet the green traffic light criteria of, quote, limited community transmission and COVID-19 hospitalisations at a manageable level?
Mr. Speaker, I can see that the member, despite saying she wasn't clear on the criteria, actually has the criteria, which she just read out in the House. Mr. Speaker, what we have already acknowledged, so that there is certainty and people can anticipate what we will do on the 29th, is yes, that is what we expect to be the status for those that are able to be in green or move into green. However, we are in a transition, and we have acknowledged that at this point, where we have a hard domestic border around an outbreak that is being lifted, it does not make sense for parts of the country during that transition to be in green, because they are likely to have to move. And so in order to have a bit more stability, we've already said that while we're in a state of transition, we will not have any part of the country in green. What I would say specifically about the South Island, and I said this when I most recently visited, fantastic levels of vaccination there. And one of the benefits of high levels of vaccination and the potential of being able to move into orange is that actually the restrictions that are currently being experienced at level two of gathering limits go, and so you'll see a lot more freedom to be able to hold those events.
When will she release individual sector guidance for the traffic light system that businesses will be operating under next week?
Mr. Speaker, the member seems to ignore the fact that the framework itself has been available since October. And we have already been in fact, in designing it, we had outreach with different sectors, specifically, for instance, hospitality, retail and so on, in the design of the framework. And some of the specifics details that are relevant to some parts, like, for instance, sport, where there are finer details to get into, those will be released this week. But, Mr. Speaker, we've had upfront consultation even in its design.
With 7 months since Delta was detected in MIQ and 3 months since Auckland has been in lockdown, why the hell hasn't this been sorted
Order.
And told
Order.
To New Zealanders first?
Order. No, the member will ask the question again.
With 7 months since Delta was detected in MIQ and 3 months since Auckland has been in lockdown, why are New Zealanders still being played like a fiddle and told we could wait till next week before you find out the answers?
Mr. Speaker, the member didn't actually ask a question that I could not answer. So that demonstrates that actually, for the most part, the most significant elements of this framework have been provided. The second point that I would make to the member, point to me anywhere in the world that is currently proposing a framework like this that we can just adopt off the shelf that actually is adapted to New Zealand's circumstances and goals.
point also to a country in the world that has currently the vaccination rates that we have at the moment and the outbreak numbers that we have at the moment. Mr. Speaker, key to our response has always been that we've designed something that is suitable for New Zealand's circumstance, based on what we're seeing in a pandemic where there was no playbook, and the result has been some of the lowest hospitalisations, death rates, case numbers, and some of the lowest unemployment, solid growth, and an economy that continues to be resilient. So, Mr. Speaker, I'd be happy to look at an alternative example, but many point to New Zealand.
And I, Dr. Nehru Leavasa.
Taftai Lava, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for COVID-19 Response. What recent decisions has the government made on New Zealand's transition to the COVID-19 protection framework?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday Cabinet confirmed that the whole country will move into the new traffic light system at 11:59pm on Thursday the 2nd of December, making next Friday the first day that the traffic light system will be operational in New Zealand. That's 10 days from now, and it's important that everybody gets prepared. Our members will be aware that we signalled that soon after the 29th of November Cabinet meeting, the country would shift to the new framework. Setting this date now gives people, communities and businesses time to prepare to move safely and smoothly into the new traffic light system. The hard truth is that Delta is here and it isn't going away, but New Zealand is very well set to tackle that because of our high vaccination rates and the latest safety measures that we've put in place, including the traffic light system and the vaccine pass.
Supplementary. When will decisions be made on where regions will move to in the framework and what factors will determine this?
Mr. Speaker, decisions on which colour each region will move into the framework will be confirmed when Cabinet meets on the 29th of November. In making these decisions, we'll be looking at a range of factors, including vaccination rates and certificates, and the general case rates of COVID-19. As we've previously said, Auckland will enter at red, and the Prime Minister has confirmed again today in the House that no region will start at green while we're transitioning and managing the current outbreak. We recognise the fact that we're in a transition environment and we would like to avoid regions being in a position where they're yo-yoing between the levels.
Supplementary. What can New Zealanders do to prepare for the transition to the new framework?
Order. Before the member goes, I know Mr Brownie hasn't spent a lot of time with us recently, but there have been some new rules in the last 4 or 5 years about order, about not interjecting while questions are being asked. Chris Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. While life will feel relatively normal under the new system, which is simpler and safer than the alert levels, it is time that we prepare to move. The number one thing that New Zealanders can do, and every New Zealander over the age of 12 can do this, is to get vaccinated. If you and your family are due for your second shot, get it as soon as you can. Vaccine passes will operate in the traffic light system, and if you aren't fully vaccinated, you'll find that you may not be able to access a range of places like bars, gyms and restaurants from the 3rd of December when proof of vaccination will be required. 83% of eligible New Zealanders are now fully vaccinated, and armed with their vaccine pass, 3.5 million Kiwis could soon start to enjoy the freedom of the summer season.
What further work is the government doing in preparation for the commencement of the framework?
Mr. Speaker, Cabinet's also decided that to ensure that the transition to the new system is as smooth as possible and to iron out any issues with the use of vaccine passes in advance of them being required on a widespread basis, we'll undertake a trial period by allowing hairdressers and barbers in Auckland to open this Thursday, from this Thursday, the 25th of November, so long as they require proof of vaccination from their customers. We'll be posting and sending out detailed sector guidance, but in short, hairdressers will need to operate with vaccine passes, take bookings only, so no walk-ins. We've chosen hairdressers to trial the passes because out of all the venues that are still closed, they pose the lowest risk by reopening. There are fewer staff employed. Generally, numbers in the space are constrained by the number of chairs and hairdressers available, and distancing between customers can be easily maintained.
Question number 5, David. Chris Bishop, supplementary question, generous.
In relation to what he's just said around hairdressers opening early, is he aware of why the Prime Minister ruled that idea out over the weekend when the Director General of Health, Ashley Bloomfield, signed the Gazette notice on Friday last week in order to give effect to
that? Order. The Prime Minister, if the Member's made an incorrect assertion, either she can leave a minister to deal with it or she can take a point of order. She can't correct errors while he's speaking.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister made no such claim.
Further supplementary? Question number five, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by all her statements and policies?
Mr. Speaker, yes, particularly the government's decision to request the Commerce Commission undertake a market study of the residential building supplies market. There have been long-standing concerns about potential competition issues, particularly due to the highly concentrated nature of some markets in the supply chain. It's clear a significant portion of the costs associated with the building residential housing is tied to building supplies, and the study will allow the Commerce Commission to investigate any factors that may affect competition for the supply or acquisition of key building supplies. The Commerce Commission will present its final report on residential building supplies in December 2022.
Does she then stand by her government's policy of the Commerce Commission doing a market study into petrol supply, where Minister Farfoy claimed it would reduce petrol prices by 18 to 32 cents? And if so, how's that one worked out?
Mr. Speaker, obviously we're seeing significant issues in the fuel market at the moment, which are not just down to those issues inquired into by the Commerce Commission.
Does she stand by her policy of making New Zealanders returning from Australia isolate in MIQ for a week? And if so, can she explain why it's okay for people who've tested positive for COVID-19 to isolate at home, but not fully vaccinated Kiwis coming home for Christmas who've tested negative for COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, as I said to the other Leader of the Opposition, that we as a government are considering changes to our MIQ's system as we speak. We've already indicated that it will change. We have made domestic changes to the domestic settings, but of course the next step is around the overseas border.
No, I
was waiting for point of order. I know the Prime Minister is aware of our constitutional arrangements whereby there is only one of that category, and I think it was a deliberate act on her part, therefore she will withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise.
Does the Prime Minister stand by her statement in question time earlier today under questioning by the Leader of the Opposition that she believes Queensland will open to travel from other states of Australia on or about December 17? And if so, what has the Government of Queensland done to prepare for that her government has not done and therefore keeps New Zealand closed to all those other states of Australia?
Mr. Speaker, obviously if you want to make comparisons, then the comparison would be the preparation around the lifting of the Auckland boundary and the preparation that we have undertaken, because the member is making comparisons around domestic border changes. The preparation we have made around that is a testing and vaccination requirement. We are easing, Mr. Speaker, our restrictions domestically. That is not to say that we will not ease our restrictions internationally. We will, but we need to step into these changes carefully. We do not want a situation where they are removed in such a way that we see dramatic changes to our ability to manage COVID-19 domestically, and that we were unable to then put in place again measures that we may need their protective factors from. Yeah. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I'd say the member only need look at, yes, we are in summer. That places you in a different position, but we only need look at Europe right now, where the World Health Organization is warning about potentially 500,000 deaths in a region that has access to vaccinations in the same way we do. And in parts of Europe, there are vaccination levels we would consider high that are moving into lockdown. We need to continue to listen to the best research and advice possible, and that is what we are doing.
What could go wrong with the vaccine certificate trial in hairdressers in Auckland from Thursday that prevented the Prime Minister including the long-suffering hospitality sector in that trial too?
Mr. Speaker, that wasn't the basis of decision making. The basis of decision making was, of course, that we are then looking to ease an area sooner than we otherwise might. The COVID protection framework kicks in from the 3rd of December, and that's when everyone moves into that model. We expect to have even higher vaccination rates and protective factors than we do now at that point. The basis of the decision was, if we are to move early, what presents the least risk? Hairdressers and barbers were on that list for the very fact that, unlike hospitality, small numbers in spaces, they are by default very easily able to separate out individuals. They have public health requirements, like, for instance, mask use, that obviously when you're in an eating and drinking establishment are different, which is why we've used them.
Does she stand by her decision to introduce the COVID-19 response vaccinations legislation bill today? And if so, why has it taken 277 days since the first dose of COVID-19 vaccine was administered in New Zealand to get the legislation ready for Parliament, leaving only 10 days for businesses to adopt before the traffic light system is scheduled to come into effect?
Mr. Speaker, firstly, on the latter part of the member's question, he appears to misunderstand the tool. There is no obligation on an employer to utilise the tool. So there is no 10-day deadline that the member is referring to. At any time, an employer could determine that they wish to use the assessment tool to ascertain whether or not they would like to put in place a vaccine mandate in their workplace. So that's the first thing I'd just quickly correct the member on. Secondly, around the legislation and the 200 plus days the member is referring to, the member seems to believe that every country around the world has gone into this pandemic believing that they would either use mandates or passes. That has not been the case. Many countries have worked iteratively through the pandemic, putting in place tools that they believe will help their situation. Some countries are still not using mandates. Many are using vast ones, including Austria, who are looking to mandate everyone in country from February. We have always looked, of course, to use the tools that make the most sense for us domestically, based on the uptake that we've been able to undertake voluntarily, but also undertaking a public health and safety risk assessment, and that is how we'll continue to progress.
Supplementary. Can she explain what will happen under the COVID-19 response vaccines legislation bill introduced to Parliament today if an unvaccinated employee takes 4 weeks off, paid by their employer, then decides, after all, they will get vaccinated and come back to work, but the employer counterclaims that it would be an unreasonable disruption to their business? Would the person get their job back or not?
Mr. Speaker, if in that intervening period an employer, for instance, believes that individual is given their undertaking that they will not be vaccinated, they've had their 4 week stand in and they go out and employ someone else, that could, for instance, Mr. Speaker, be considered to be an unreasonable disruption for that business.
Question number six, Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Has he sought advice on the number of businesses that may be forced to close once current financial support is reworked as part of the traffic light system? If so, how many businesses?
Speaker, the government moved quickly to put financial support in place for businesses as the COVID-19 pandemic spread around the world, and we have supported hundreds of thousands of businesses to get through and to keep their employees working. In terms of the specifics of the member's question, I reject its apparent premise. The advice I do have is that all businesses have the ability to operate under all three levels of the COVID protection framework.
Which businesses will be eligible for financial support payments under the new traffic light system?
Mr. Speaker, as I signalled on October the 22nd when we announced the framework, it is our intention to move away from broad-based supports under the protection framework and move towards more targeted support, looking particularly at specific sectors. We'll have announcements to make about that in due course.
Why, a month after announcing the traffic light system, has he still not provided details about what financial support will be available to businesses at each colour, and particularly red and orange?
Mr. Speaker, as I've just said in my earlier answer, on the 22nd of October, I outlined the fact that under the green and orange levels, we did not expect there to be widespread support for businesses. Under the red level, we would expect it to be much more targeted. I'll have more to say about that in due course.
Will the financial support under the traffic light system specifically address the 46% of Auckland businesses who can't afford to pay their rent?
Mr. Speaker, we've had increasing levels of support under the resurgence support payment. We've indicated that there will also be a transition payment. Any future support under the red level, we will announce in due course.
Will he be introducing any initiatives to reactivate hospitality businesses as strongly advocated for by organisations such as the Heart of the City and Restaurant Association, so that they can rely on trade, not government financial support?
Well, the member seems to be highly confused, because all of the questions, supplementary questions up until that point, had been asking for more government support. I have met with the Restaurant Association, I have met with Heart of the City. They are aware of the fact that we have heard their concerns, and we'll have more to say in due course. Wow.
Question number 7, Nancy Chen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Economic and Regional Development. What reports has he seen on the state of venture capital industry?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr. Speaker, last month PwC, the Angel Association of New Zealand and New Zealand Growth Capital Partners, released a report that showed New Zealand has a startup ecosystem that is more self-sufficient and sustainable than at any point in the past. It demonstrated not only resilience but an increase in maturity. New Zealand Growth Capital Partners administers a $300 million Elevate Fund and this $80 million Aspire Seed Fund on behalf of the New Zealand Government. The report stated, and I quote, "Interest in New Zealand startup investment did not diminish in 2020, despite some dire predictions early in the year as COVID-19 struck. $158 million was invested in 108 deals, and this is the third year of $100 million plus of investment in startups, and also the third year of more than 20% year-on-year growth in dollars invested."
Supplementary. What role has the Elevate and Aspire funds made to the successes of the venture capital industry?
Mr. Speaker, to date, the Elevate Fund has made total commitments of $157 million and crowded in over $430 million of private capital, including investments from New Zealand Super Fund and Kiwi Wealth. This has resulted in almost $600 million available to invest in promising New Zealand companies at the venture capital stage, which is by far and away the largest amount we have seen invested in New Zealand venture capital stage in the last 10 years. The Aspire Fund invested $10.8 million into 14 new investments in 2021 financial year, a notable increase on prior years.
Supplementary. What are examples of the types of firms helped by Elevate and Aspire?
Mr. Speaker, one example, Kiwi startup Energy Bank raised nearly $2.7 million in an oversubscribed seed round led by Icehouse Ventures New Zealand and the newly created fund Nuance Connected Capital, which Elevate backed this year with a $17 million commitment. Energy Bank aims to develop a new technology for storing energy, which it claims is better than pumped hydro or lithium-ion batteries, and could help decarbonise electricity grids in 42 countries within 30 to 40 years. Another example, Mr. Speaker, deep tech company Aquafortis has developed a technology that uses a fraction of the energy of thermal systems to separate wastewater into dry mineral salts and clean water.
Question number 8, Jan Logie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Building and Construction and asks, is she satisfied that carbon emissions in the building and construction sector are being reduced fast enough to meet the government's emission reduction goals?
Mr. Speaker, as a government, we are committed to improving the quality of our built environment. That's why the government's Building for Climate Change program is undertaking work to drive long-term change in the building and construction sector to meet the challenges posed by climate change. The policies and measures being developed will ensure that the sector makes a significant contribution to meeting our emissions reduction and other climate change goals.
Supplementary. Will she amend the building code to have a higher standard for energy efficiency and create a trajectory to near zero energy buildings by 2030?
Mr. Speaker,
The upcoming changes to the New Zealand Building Code's energy efficiency requirements will lift the minimum levels of insulation for new buildings. These changes are expected to reduce the energy needed for heating and cooling by about 40% for new homes and by about 23% for new large non-residential buildings. This will make new homes and buildings easier to heat and cool, healthier and more comfortable. The changes will also provide clearer requirements for energy efficiency of heating, ventilation and air conditioning systems in new commercial buildings.
Supplementary. Will she provide incentives for those building to higher than code, such as faster building consents and energy performance information for potential buyers?
Mr. Speaker, we are looking at a whole programme of works, including our Building for Climate Change programme, our Carbon Neutral Government programme, and also the consultation we're currently undertaking around our emissions reductions plans. All of these things are designed to build better, build more efficiently and more energy efficient homes and buildings.
Why has the government not made it a mandatory requirement to publish an energy rating for any office building, public or private, as they've had in place in Australia for more than a decade?
Mr. Speaker, there are tools available for people to understand to reduce their building's emissions. Mr. Speaker, one such tool is NABANS, which is a voluntary tool to measure and compare energy efficiency and carbon performance for commercial buildings. While the government does use NABANS to reduce emissions in cases where it's appropriate, there are a range of other available tools to help us reduce buildings' emissions.
Does she recognise the increased urgency to changing rules to provide for lower emission buildings when we have record construction and new urban density laws about to come into force?
Mr. Speaker, I recognise that we have a programme of work to undertake. The building and construction sector is a key contributor to our emissions reductions plans. We are also key contributors through the Building for Climate Change program. This government is looking at all the levers it can pull to ensure that we reduce our emissions.
Question number 9, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for COVID-19 response. How many fully vaccinated people, if any, who have travelled from Australia since 23 August 2021 have tested positive for COVID-19 in New Zealand? And how many travellers from Australia have completed stays in managed isolation and quarantine since 23 August 2021?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, it's important to remember that the entire outbreak that we are dealing with right now, which has over 7,000 cases associated with it, stems from a single traveller travelling from Australia to New Zealand. I'm advised that between the 23rd of August and the 15th of November, 2,544 travellers from Australia have completed stays in MIQ. Three of these people tested positive. None of those people were vaccinated. While that's a small number, it still signifies the risks that exist with overseas returnees. To put this into context of our overall experience of MIQ returnees, we've had 92 cases amongst 26,000 returnees since the 23rd of August, 50 of whom had received some form of vaccination, and 46 of whom were fully vaccinated. So these numbers reiterate the importance that any decisions around the border must ensure that risk is carefully managed to reduce any potential impacts on vulnerable communities and the New Zealand health system. That is why we've taken a phased approach to reconnecting with the world, and I look forward to giving more details on that in the coming days.
So can you just confirm that the number of fully vaccinated people from Australia to have travelled to New Zealand and subsequently tested positive for COVID-19 from the 23rd of August 2021 to the 15th of November is zero?
Mr. Speaker, if the member listened carefully to my primary answer, yes, that is the answer.
In light of that answer, why can a vaccinated Aucklander leave Auckland after December 17 and travel around New Zealand without a COVID test, but a vaccinated person in Australia with a negative pre-departure test can't travel to Auckland?
Mr. Speaker, I think if the member was listening to the Prime Minister's answers to his leader's questions a little earlier, he will have seen that we are taking a staged and a phased and managed approach to increasing the risk to the rest of New Zealand of COVID-19 cases coming into their community. There's no doubt there will be COVID-19 cases making its way into other parts of the New Zealand community, but we still want to reduce the risk associated with that, and therefore staging that and managing that to ensure that we're not piling a whole host of additional risk all at the same time on the rest of the country is an important public health measure.
Well, in light of the fact that zero people who have been fully vaccinated have travelled to New Zealand and tested positive in the last 2 months, would a phased approach to the reopening of the New Zealand border, just simply to allow people from Australia who are fully vaccinated with pass negative COVID tests to travel to New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, if the member listened to my primary answer, the statement that he made at the beginning of his question is factually incorrect. 50 people who have been vaccinated have tested positive for COVID-19 on arrival in New Zealand.
Question 10, Ibrahim Omar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety. How are the government supporting business to get their workforce vaccinated?
The Honourable Michael Ward.
Mr. Speaker, vaccine requirements in the workplace are a common tool in many countries around the world that are being used to stop the spread of COVID-19 and to protect their workers and customers from the virus. Today we have announced that we are supporting businesses to help get their workers vaccinated.
Sorry, I'm going to ask to interrupt the member. There are two members over there, one of whom is slightly louder than the other. And the one in front is slightly more frequent than the other. But they've both been very noisy today. I don't understand the reason for it, but I'm just asking them to wind it back. Michael Wood, can you start again, please?
Mr. Speaker, vaccine requirements in the workplace are common tools in many countries around the world being used to stop the spread of COVID-19 and to protect workers and customers from the virus. Today we have announced that we are supporting businesses to help get their workers vaccinated and keep people safe by providing them with a new vaccination tool, a clear legal framework to help them make decisions about when vaccines might be reasonably required in the workplace. The tool will specify four key factors, at least three of which must be met before it would be reasonable to require vaccination for particular work.
Supplementary. How will this benefit business?
Mr. Speaker, we've had calls from both businesses and unions to make the process around worker vaccination as clear as possible. This simple four-step tool will make it much easier for businesses, particularly small businesses without large legal and HR support. This new process won't override existing risk assessments that businesses have already done under existing health and safety guidelines, and businesses will continue being able to choose which one they use, either the new vaccination tool or health and safety risk assessment processes.
Supplementary. How will the tool develop?
Mr. Speaker, over recent weeks we have worked collaboratively to develop the new vaccination tool to ensure that it's well informed and is able to be used in a very practical way on the ground. We've consulted extensively, including with Business New Zealand and the CTU. We've taken public health advice and we've worked closely with WorkSafe as the regulator in this area. As such, Mr. Speaker, I have real confidence that the vaccination tool is going to be of significant benefit to businesses and workers in providing much needed clarity.
Question number 11, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Housing, Public Housing, and asks, does she have confidence in the way Kāinga Ora is implementing its, quote, sustainable tenancies, quote, policy? And what advice, if any, has she had about whether Kāinga Ora's policy to, quote, preserve and not terminate tenancies, quote, has placed it in breach of its obligations as a landlord under the Residential Tenancies Act 1986?
Honourable Cody Williams.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, to the first part of the member's question, yes. The sustaining tenancies policy was initiated in early 2017 and it provides Kāinga Ora with a range of tools to address issues of disruptive behaviour, which includes working at a local level to provide the support needed to resolve these issues. It can also include the relocation of tenants, and as I advised the House last week, this has occurred on 159 occasions in the past year. In answer to the second part of the member's question, I've received a briefing from Kāinga Ora on recent incidents of disruptive behaviour and how they are continuing to implement the sustaining tenancies policy. However, it's a long-standing convention that ministers do not comment directly on individual judicial matters or provide legal opinions to the House.
Supplementary. Has she directed Kāinga Ora to review how it deals with abusive tenants following a series of harrowing stories in which innocent tenants have been persistently terrorised by their neighbours? And if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, Kāinga Ora takes issues of disruptive behaviour seriously, and I encourage anyone with concerns to raise it with them and with Kāinga Ora. Mr Speaker, there's no doubt that the current situation that tenants are experiencing in Whangarei in particular is particularly distressing. This is a hard situation that we're facing here. Kāinga Ora has taken the sustaining tenancies program, they've improved it, they've added tools to the toolkit. But if I can quote the member herself, evictions are not always the answer. It is a requirement of this government to support people to sustain their homes, because the alternative would mean children being homeless and people living in cars.
Supplementary. Why should frightened tenants take this minister seriously when, despite warnings about their case last week, an elderly Whangarei couple were this weekend forced to cower inside their home after their abusive Kāinga Ora neighbours held a Black Power party at which a police officer was allegedly assaulted and a patrol car compromised?
Order. Order. That question doesn't go to this minister's responsibility.
Mr Speaker, point of order?
A point of order, Nicola Willis.
Just clarify with what I said in the question. I asked her about why tenants should take the Minister's expressions of concern seriously. She is responsible.
That's exactly where she missed, because she has no responsibility for them, for their views. Further supplementary, Nicola Willis.
Supplementary.
Order.
Is it?
Order. Was that Mr Bedott or Mr Bishop who made that comment then? There was a comment made by one of those two members. Mr Bennett, did you make a comment? Sorry?
I said brick.
You said what? At my ruling. Right, we will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise.
Supplementary.
No, and does... loss of one supplementary as a result of that. Further supplementary, Nicola Willis.
Supplementary. Is it sufficient for Kāinga Ora to just relocate chronically abusive tenants when one such relocated tenant, now living in Nai Nai, has gone on to terrorise his new neighbour, including reportedly threatening to kill him while wielding a spade?
Mr Speaker, it's never acceptable behaviour. Kāinga Ora work very hard to ensure that all tenants can enjoy safe and peaceful tenancies. They use the sustaining tenancies tool, which wraps support around tenants and neighbours to ensure that in the vast proportion of cases, situations are resolved. These are difficult, hard, complex cases, but I can advise the House that by and large the tools that Kāinga Ora uses in this regard have worked. They have worked, they have been improved since the time the National Party introduced them, and they continue to work in most cases.
However, there are cases where they are very difficult, they are very hard, and that is when Kāinga Order insists that if the sustaining tenancy initial policy doesn't work, then they move to relocate. If that doesn't work, then termination of tenancies will occur.
Question.
Supplementary. No, well, the members actually had one extra supplementary, which I'll deal with tomorrow, but question number 12, Willow Jean Prime.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Conservation. What progress has been made on establishing a marine mammal sanctuary in the Bay of Islands?
The Honourable Kiritapu Alam.
Mr. Speaker, on 17 November, I announced that a marine mammal sanctuary will be established in Te Pea Whairangi, the Bay of Islands, coming into effect on December the 15th. The sanctuary has been established after a public consultation process and aims to not only reverse the decline in the numbers of bottlenose dolphins in the area, but better protect visiting orcas and fur seals as well. By designating this area a sanctuary, we are creating an environment where the human-animal interaction coexists rather than disrupts, while also protecting an amazing taonga for future generations.
Supplementary, why is the sanctuary being established?
Mr. Speaker, the Bay's bottlenose dolphin, which are nationally endangered species, are known to spend an average of about 86% of their daylight hours with at least one boat nearby. They're cheeky little things, and extensive studies have shown that near constant presence of people and boats disrupts the normal behaviours critical for their survival. They like to play, so they don't get as much rest and kai as they need. The new speed and distant restrictions where people and boats are interacting with marine mammals aim to protect the mammals while also providing sustainable tourism opportunities through maintaining one of the major draw cards for visitors, the presence of the dolphins in the bay.
Supplementary, what public feedback was received on the proposal?
Mr. Speaker, public consultation has been a big part of the process over the last 6 months, and I want to acknowledge the 645 submitters and note that over 66% of those submitters were in full support. In particular, Mr. Speaker, I want to acknowledge Ngā Hapū o Te Pea Whairangi, who have been constant guardians of this project.
The sub-tribes of Northland.
In an exemplary way with the Department of Conservation on our collective journey to protect the dolphins. I also want to acknowledge the local boaties who will continue to use and enjoy the beautiful waters of Te Pea Whairangi over the summer, which includes fishing throughout the area. And because there are no restrictions specific to that sanctuary on fishing, and do this in a way that allows our marine mammals to thrive.
That concludes oral questions.